Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Mark, if folks haven't realized over the past 7 years that EB5 is never without drama, I have no words. We have the latest controversy going on, and it's something which has been around for some time. We've actually covered it before on our podcasts. In fact, there's very little that we haven't recovered on our podcasts.
Right. 7 years, there's drama going every which way. But what's the drama today?
Sustainment of the investment. Why is this such a big deal? It's such a big deal because we're talking about, I would say this is one of the most important topics for the industry today, because we're talking about an estimated $15 billion and climbing invested into projects all over the U.S. This amount of money is what is potentially redeployed, if not already redeployed. And I will tell you this also, Mark, is that there are a lot of differing viewpoints here. We did think very carefully when we were setting up this podcast as to whether we want to be more investor focused or whether we wanted to be more regional center focused. And then we decided, no, we needed someone right in the middle who was industry focused. And who better than our old friend, Ronnie Fieldstone. Welcome, Ronnie.
Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
As always, you're one of our go-to people, Ronnie. And you are somebody who is very familiar with redeployment and sustainment of investment.
Correct. We've been involved in multiple transactions over the past, starting after June 4th, 2017, when we got a direction from the policy memo from USCIS. Redeployment became an industry at that point in time.
Well, for any new listener who doesn't know what redeployment is, I suppose you and I should really give them a quick summary as to what redeployment is. So under EB5 regulations, money, the capital investment, needs to be sustained for a period of time. With all of the delays that have been happening and with some of the projects managing to complete a little earlier than planned, the money has come back into either the project or the regional center, Ronnie. And then what happens?
First of all, ideally, a project eventually repays either the investment. So the investment could be a loan. It could be a loan model where the NCE, sponsored by the regional center, has a loan repaid in whole or in part, or it could be an equity contribution. A lot of EB5 deals are preferred equity. Either way, when money is paid back, what happens when the investors have not satisfied, quote, the immigration requirement, which is the big hot topic today. I realize we're going to get into the, what does that mean, satisfying the immigration requirement. So the industry before June 14th, 2017, always assumed that you had to have 829 adjudication your money back.
That was the regulations. USCIS did change that.
That's right.
It wasn't an assumption. It was actually in the regulations. Because look, all of the old offering documents have that you cannot have a return of your capital until the 829 has been approved, not even filed.
Yeah. And the policy memo clarified, which was kind of obvious, to say, wait a minute, we really didn't mean that. So they defined the concept of sustainment period, which is pretty straightforward. It means from the time you get a conditional residency, either by a visa and entering the United States with a passport or you can talk about that more of the form 485 change of status. If you're in the country, the moment you get that conditional residency, you start a clock, and that's a 2-year clock. And that 2-year clock means you, as long as you sustain your at-risk requirement, meaning you don't get your money back on any level, after 2 years, you are now free to get your money back. Notwithstanding the fact that your I-829 petition, which has probably just been filed around the same time, could take years to get resolved. And of course, that's another hot topic. How long does I-829 take to get resolved? But at least you can now get your money back. You're already in the country. You have a conditional residency permission. And at least the prejudice of the 829 delay goes away a lot, because you're now entitled to get your money back and you have the benefits of having a U.S. conditional residency. That was the concept behind it. And that's been the industry through that moment in time in 2017 through recent times when an issue has arisen very recently interpreting the new act.
Right. But let's be fair here. Let's go back a little bit for our audience. Back in 2017, when all of this first came out, immigration attorneys like ourselves, like your firm, and a couple of others, they did come out and they argued in favor of the investor. So right now, I have to say, Ronnie, that there's a lot of regional centers who initially we did consider having come onto this podcast, and they politely declined because they really didn't want to give their opinion. Now, and I know why they really did not want to come onto a podcast like this. They did not want to show that, look, we really want redeployment to stay there, because everybody wants to look as though they are, investor friendly. And here's the reality. The good regional centers, or the regional centers out there who really take care and follow the rules and follow the best practices, do find safe, good investments to redeploy funds and follow correctly. And a lot of them do consult their investors. But there are bad actors out there, or there are careless actors, I should say, maybe not bad actors.
Yeah, well, first of all, I can understand why a regional center would be reluctant to take a position, because they're sponsoring projects and they don't want to take a position that would be adverse in any way, whatever position they take, because there's two sides of the, one could argue there's two sides of the equation. Do you accelerate the ability to get money back, or do you not accelerate? And that's really the topic. And the regional centers, to some degree, at least individually, probably don't want to take a position that may otherwise affect the offerings or the projects they're sponsoring. So they're waiting for the March 20th stakeholder meeting, which we presume, not guaranteed, will at least shine light on this issue, because it is a scheduled agenda item. I can understand if you're sponsoring multiple projects, why take a position that could be prejudicial to the project you're sponsoring? I completely understand that. But on the other hand, I think from an industry standpoint, I shouldn't say all agree, but mostly agree that if you had a time period where the two-year sustainment would begin when you made the loan, or the money was applied by the investor to the NCE that made the loan, and you would then be entitled to receive your money back in 2 years, what would that do to the industry?
Exactly.
That's a problem.
Yeah, well, so here's the thing. There has to be a balance. We have, back in 2017, there really wasn't anybody for the investors. And now we have a group, AIIA, who've actually been on our podcast, I believe, Mark. But they have come out with their opinion. And I feel as though their opinion is a little skewed, because it doesn't really look at the business standpoint. You've been doing redeployment. You've been doing these in your documents forever. Don't you see that redeployment really helps to attract the better projects? And it's not realistic for business to be able to return funds within 2 years. I mean, if they're going to return funds in 2 years after all the hoops that you have to go through for EB-5, why bother with EB-5?
Yeah, well, I think it's a two-stage question. And they're connected and they're not connected. The first issue is, if you had a two-year time frame where the money would come back, number one, you look, who's paying the money? Who's returning the money? The developer, the developer, the borrower, they're returning money. If you go to the developer and say, oh, guess what now? The industry now requires, or is presuming, unlike before, that we're going to give you money, but you got to give it back to us in 2 years. Now, first of all, that is unrealistic when you're dealing with typically an EB-5 project. By definition, it requires job creation.
Right.
And to get job creation, especially if it's a real estate project, which is a majority of the EB-5 money, that's 3 to 5 years before you build, finish, stabilize, and have the ability to refinance or sell, which is usually the way that money gets paid back. If you say to somebody, oh, by the way, here's the money, that's the good news. The bad news is you have to get it back in a short time. So right away, that would eliminate, I think, a lot of good projects that would just say this for the cost of doing business, because we all know in the industry, generally, it's the borrower developer
Yeah.
It ends up funding most of the cost to reimburse the sponsors for the cost to get to market, for the filing fees, for the offering documents. I can go on and on, but we all understand how the industry works that way. So if you had that time frame, it would really have, from an economic point of view, a terrible effect. Secondly, those projects, I would wonder what projects would agree to give money back in 2 years. Then you start worrying, and I think you said it correctly. You want to go with a legitimate developer, a high-level project. Nobody wants to give money back in 2 years. It just doesn't make sense. You cannot amortize the cost
Yes.
of getting involved in EB-5 in 2 years. If it's 5 years to 7 years, which is the norm, then it's justifiable. Secondly, as a matter of reference, because it's public information, there was a letter sent by John Cornyn, senator from Texas, on January 24th,
Going to ask you about that. Yes.
Yeah, to Secretary Mayorkas. And he said the same thing. He said it's not realistic in creating tension that you try to pay money back in that time period. It just doesn't make sense. And he took that position, too, that the intent was never in the statute that it would be inconsistent with the RIA to otherwise now accelerate the time period for which an investor can get their money back. And the other concept is don't forget, the RIA was supposed to, one, help the investor, and at the second time, not otherwise allow the investor to get a shortcut. I mean, let's understand, the investor has to have their money deployed to create the jobs. And if you got them their money back in 2 years, I don't think that was the intent of the legislation, would to get them that type of additional benefit that was not contemplated. The RIA was primarily there to protect the investor in many ways from bad actors. So I think that you would eliminate a lot of players in the industry. Like, for instance, how does a regional center otherwise sustain itself, pay its expenses?
Exactly, exactly. Here's the thing. Last week, I was with other people from the leadership of IIUSA lobbying on the Hill. And we spoke to a number of staffers from the House and stuff. And of course, a lot of them aren't familiar with EB-5. One staffer did ask, oh, isn't this just buying a green card? And we had to go through the explanation. No, this isn't buying a green card because, and then gave them all the steps as to, you know, the time and the entrepreneurial nature of this program. And also point out the fact that this is one of the only programs in the whole world where you are creating jobs. Again, you are right. If you have a 2 year period, and I'm not siding with the regional centers over investors or one way or the other, it just doesn't make business sense. You cannot create jobs if you are going to take your money back within 2 years, because how many businesses are even profitable in year one, let alone in year two?
Well, if you look at the job count, yeah. You know, in The Economist, you have direct and indirect jobs. We all know that to get the direct and indirect jobs on construction, your construction period's got to go 2 years. So as a practical matter, even the job creation model would be greatly influenced if a project construction was less than 2 years, which can happen, but generally most vertical buildings, vertical projects, clearly over 2 years, even horizontal projects that are development phasing transactions, even home builders that are building homes over an extended period of time in a project, which is perfectly legitimate, that could take several years. So again, this is kind of throwing the industry in a tizzy, I guess you would say. I don't think.
Okay, but Ronnie, but to balance everything, the investor's viewpoint is that there has been an abuse of redeployment. Not every regional center has followed best practices. Have you seen any of that, an abuse of redeployment?
Yeah, well, so that's a separate issue. Let's understand the issues. One is, what's a reasonable time period in the industry for funds to be out there before they're redeployed? And the second issue is, you're correct that if money is given back so quickly, you're not redeploying anymore. And I guess the argument is, well, maybe we don't want to redeploy, but that doesn't make sense, because right now, if the processing times were more realistic or reasonable, let's understand, the head of USCIS announced publicly, correctly so, that she admitted in one of the stakeholder meetings that they were embarrassed that they weren't adjudicating faster and she was going to try to fix it. I give her a lot of credit for that.
She
stood up and she said, look, we have not done this right. We got to do better. We got to hire more people. The new RIA created more dollars, a lot more dollars to cover the cost of that. And we're hoping that the adjudication times, if the adjudication times were back when I first started back in, you know, 2009, 2010, where adjudications were being done.
Two months,
6 months. You wouldn't even have redeployment would probably be a non-issue.
Because when you
do the math, you come to the country, you're here, you do your 2 year sustainment, the loan matures, you're not redeploying at all. You wouldn't even be redeploying. So the redeployment arose because of retrogression, primarily in China, also India, Vietnam for a short time, and because the delay in just adjudications to get people a 526 and get in the country is so long that the industry, from a regulatory standpoint, has created this huge backlog that's necessitated extending the at-risk requirement and therefore necessitating redeployment. Now, I don't think the new act directly tells you how to redeploy with a few exceptions.
Yes.
There is a lot of requirements on the regional center and on the participants to continuously certify that they are complying with the RIA. Well, what does that do? It imposes a lot more obligations on diligence. And so therefore, when you talk about redeployment, I mean, forgetting the law, there's a what I call an ethical and industry standard and investor protection obligation. And that is due diligence, independence, arm's length negotiations, making sure the if it's a loan, it's administered properly with some independence. And things like that, we need
to... Yeah, but Ronnie, things can happen. You see, again, to come up with the investor standpoint, you could have all the due diligence you like, but then circumstances can change. And then at a later stage, if your money is returned and then it's lost in a second offering, which the investor has no choice about. I mean, that's the area here where we're really looking
at. Well, that's a very good question. So when we do redeployment, what do we do? First of all, we look at the corporate documents. And since the policy memo was adopted, a lot of offering documents immediately focused on redeployment and then put standards there. Some gave investors consent. Some had a lot of documents we did had detailed requirements of loan to cost, loan to value, standards where the redeployment had to be within a certain criteria, things like that where there's direction.
Yeah.
And then we advise anybody redeploying that they got to treat it like a brand new, even though it's technically not a securities offering. In one hand, it's got to be treated like that because you're going to investors and you're redeploying their money. I don't think that's a security, but you have corporate issues of governance, which is just as important, that you need to make sure that they're getting the same type of protections they got on the first round.
So what's your solution here? So if you had USCIS listening to you right now, I'll tell you what I would say. My personal solution is redeployment should not be part of USCIS because I don't think USCIS is equipped either they have with experienced officers, nor do they have the resources nor the time to administer anything in relation to redeployment checks. I think redeployment itself should be moved out of USCIS and taken to Chamber of Commerce. And I've been arguing this since 2020.
Yeah.
That's my opinion. I don't know what you would have as a solution.
Well, I have an opinion, but it's not agreeing or disagreeing with you. The question is, can USCIS staff the appropriate people to otherwise, when they do their inspections, because they're doing inspections of regional centers like at least every 2 years now, and there's money to do that, and they're visiting projects, which is good. I don't know if they're visiting redeployment transactions or clearly visiting all existing projects to make sure they get completed and the jobs are created. And I understand they actually make personal visits now to do that.
Yes.
They have to do that. They're taking pictures.
But there's a lot of controversy about these personal visits, though. They're sending people out without, they come randomly. And then there's often somebody in the office or wherever the site is or whatever who doesn't know who they are or doesn't even understand about EB-5. And then wrong questions are coming out and then the reports aren't there. I know there are a ton of problems with the site visits.
Yeah,
so they leave a lot to be desired. That's why I'm saying I don't believe USCIS has the resources to handle redeployment.
Could be. Yeah. Well, the question is, it's an interesting industry issue.
Right.
Clearly, the initial project, it's policed. There's reporting. There's detailed requirements related to that.
Initial project. Yeah, we're
one
not talking argue, about that.
Mm. Yeah, but one would argue, well, the regional center is still sustaining a project. There is a continuing obligation to report to make sure you maintain the at-risk requirement. in that program. Now, what from an economic point of view, there may not be any specific requirements as to governance and what you do once you pay the first loan or investment back. But from an industry point of view, if you don't do it right, what we advise clients is if you don't do it right, you then subject the sponsor, potentially the developer, maybe or maybe not the regional center to litigation for improperly, one, not returning money that should be returned. What happens if an investor withdraws and you repay? Why wouldn't you give them their money back? That question comes up all the time.
Right.
How do you deal with an investor that already met the 2-year sustainment period? Are you going to give them their money back? Depends on what the documents say. But generally, we advise from an investor standpoint, if you've done what you've had to do and you met your 2-year sustainment period and the money's prepaid, you know, it's reasonable to assume that you should be treated appropriately as long as it doesn't prejudice the redeployment. Now, you have a, what becomes complicated is where you have partial repayments. Now it gets really complicated.
Yes. And that's happening, Ronnie, more and more.
You have a $50 million loan and you get repaid $25 million.
Yeah. Okay. But Ronnie, they're not every project we know right now. Interest rates are sky high. And the chances are, with everything I have read, that the interest rates are going to go up. If the interest rates are going to go up even more, nobody is refinancing. So here we're looking at extension of loans. Secondly, what if a project is not doing well? And you know, there's a lot of projects out there right now who are just recovering from COVID. And it's actually now that some of the real effects of COVID are taking place. And thirdly, and I know there's a compound question here, what about projects which are operational and that they don't necessarily, you know, there isn't a payback in the same way they would be as a real estate?
Well, all good questions. First of all, when we do offering documents, there's always an exit strategy. You always have an exit strategy. So usually if it's a loan, it's always a clear-cut exit strategy. It's a maturity date with an extension right. Now, as you said correctly, COVID, the economy, and inability to refinance, all those issues, cost increases, are headwinds.
And
developers legitimately may be having trouble where they budgeted a refinance to take out EB-5. They can no longer get the amount of money they need. They may get partial refinancing, but not whole.
Yeah, but Ronnie, why would somebody refinance at a super high rate when it's EB-5 money and they don't need to refinance at that rate? It doesn't make sense. So that those situations are there.
Well, that's a good question. And a lot depends on the asset class. And I'll give you an example. EB-5 rates started a lot lower, have been getting higher. As we all know, they've moved up the chain over the last several years. Now they're even higher because rates are higher. And that's not good or bad. It's just reality that developers will pay higher rates today because if they go to the regular market, they're going to pay the same rate. EB-5 used to be a bargain rate. It's no longer. So to some degree, EB-5 has always been below what the industry is. Now, when you're talking about a refi, if you have a multifamily project, I can tell you now, if it's a good multifamily project, you're refinancing for less than 5%. The rate is actually not so bad. Multifamily is one of the exceptions in the industry because you have institutional lenders that will give you very reasonable rates, like Freddie, Fannie, and HUD.
Well, that's a multi-rate, but I've seen lately we've got projects which are, for example, assisted living, and they're not getting refinanced less than 8-9%.
Yeah, well, that's a business because you're operating more of a business. That's true. There's different asset classes and the rates are higher. Absolutely correct. So you're not wrong that the EB-5 rate many times is much more reasonable than the going rate, and the developer won't qualify when they go to get a loan to refinance the senior and the EB-5, the economics don't work because the rates are too high to meet the requirements of a full refi. Now, that's why sometimes we see partial refis where the EB-5 is partially refied because a developer is able to get X but not Y because the room to cover isn't there. When the rates are really low, life is easier. So when we were talking 2 years ago, when we were hitting low rates and people were refinancing, there, the rates really got low.
So should there be a penalty if there is, you know, because we're looking at sustainment and redeployment. Let's just come back to the issue here. Should there be a penalty written in, or do you think, again, that will dissuade many projects from taking EB-5?
Well, we find in many cases, if the loan is not repaid on time and it's extended, the interest rate goes up. And there's the penalty is, if it's a preferred equity transaction, the preferred return goes up. So sophisticated lending people who are in the industry, it's a lot of sophistication in the industry, in the higher end. These are taken into account in the way the project is structured to take into account delays to otherwise reward the lender and its participants by giving a higher rate or a higher return. So that's one of the ways it's done, as opposed to just foreclosing, or nobody wants to foreclose a project. I mean, nobody wants to do that. If you have to, you do it. But really, that's not what people try to do, especially where people are having difficulty in this environment. So that's one of the solutions.
But Ronnie, I would like your opinion. You can give it. I promise I won't tell anybody. What do you really feel should be the stance that USCIS take?
Oh, clearly. I mean, there's no question in my mind. They have to stick with the current program, what everybody's been dealing with for the last 5.5 years with the June 14th, 2017 policy memo. I think we've been living with it. We've been working with it. It's been working well with proper supervision and diligence. The industry is starting to police itself better with the redeployment. It's much more organized than it used to be. It's become a major industry, as you noted.
Yeah.
There's an estimated
$15 billion. $15 billion.
Yes, it's a lot.
So what I would actually, I mean, I happen to agree with you, but as I said, I feel like that there should be other measures. As I said, redeployment should be taken away from USCIS, and perhaps an investor should be educated more to read the small print and see what would happen if the funds were redeployed. And then maybe that would encourage them to go into a project or not to go into a project.
We in documents try to set standards for redeployment. A lot of times the standard could be at least as good as the current project, no worse. If whatever made you invest in the current project, that it won't be the standard, whatever it is, will be at least as good as what you did on the first round. So the risk you're taking is no greater than what you took the first round.
All right. And what do you feel about the purchase of secondary financial instruments as an alternative?
Well, that's an at-risk secondary financial obligations. You mean publicly traded, not publicly traded? I mean, bonds, you know, bonds is a big issue. If there's a market for bonds and it doesn't qualify, it's an at-risk requirement. I mean, USCIS has imposed this at-risk requirement on the redeployment of money because that's their position. They could have taken a different approach or could have given the money back, but their position is we want you to stay at risk. And ideally, the money needs to be, you know, redeployed in a similar, don't forget it, under the current rules, it's got to be in a similar business. So okay. If you're in real estate, theoretically, if you build a building and you want to redeploy it in another building, it could be a different real estate building. I think that's okay. But you have to be consistent with the current business plan, as I understand the redeployment rules and regulations today.
Yeah, and I think it also goes back to the reason that it is an at-risk program. At the end of the day, you have to take a chance. Somebody took a chance on Amazon when they were still in somebody's garage, and somebody took a chance on Microsoft. And I think that is the encouragement here, that one of these projects, maybe another Microsoft or maybe another Amazon, but only if you allow it. Because if there was a guarantee here, who is ever going to invest in a lot of the projects which are out there?
Yeah, correct. And by the way, let's understand that a substantial majority, well over 90% of EB-5 funds, both initially and redeployment, are in real estate-based projects. Land. I mean, that includes hotels, even though it's an operating business. It's real estate-based. So really, most of the money is real estate-based. And the obvious reason for that is because investors like a fixed asset and not an operating business. They feel more comfortable. Unless you're dealing with a large company that's guaranteeing the loan, then if you have an operating business, there's a little less concern. Even senior housing is real estate based because it's a building. It's an operating business, but it's a building.
Yes and no. I mean, yes, there is real estate connected somewhere, but a lot of these are businesses. For example, we have pharmaceutical projects and, you know, yes, the EB-5 job creation came out of constructing the business, but the business is a business. The hotel is a business. So there may be a real estate aspect, but there is an underlying business to this.
That's correct. But I distinguish between a hotel or a senior living because it's still real estate based. It can be converted to another use. It's a solid asset. Most of the money is going into the bricks and mortar, and that's how you get your jobs, as opposed to a pharmaceutical company where you're building a warehouse and a lot of the money may be going to working capital. So when you look at EB-5, not a lot of money in construction projects goes to working capital. Most of it goes into the bricks and mortar.
It's more the structure than the staff, is what you're saying.
Yes.
Well, the one thing for sure, Ronnie, is that this entire area requires more dialogue. I think that there is too much ignorance out there on stuff. And the more dialogue we have from maybe podcasts, webinars, articles, the investor needs to be informed. The investor needs to understand. And the investor also needs to look at who are drafting the documents and what kind of documents are out there.
I agree.
Understanding redeployment is key. Some may say it's a keystone. And that having been said, Ronnie Fieldstone, thank you so much for coming on EB-5 Investment Voice.
Pleasure.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Make sure you don't miss our next episode focusing on a different aspect of the EB-5 program by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.